the hard part is, I think, over my career doing this, is building those relationships and making sure you have those connections so that in the event of emergency, we know who to call, we know what to do, and hopefully we never have that problem. Unfortunately, our adversaries have different designs. And so, you know, making sure that we have those pre-established relationships will really help get power back on, get water back running in the event of a bad day, and then ultimately so that we can get better as a nation.
Welcome to the National Governors Association Cybersecurity Podcast. This is Jeff McLeod, Director of NGA's Homeland Security and Public Safety Division. When it comes to cybersecurity, critical infrastructure presents some of the most serious risks and challenges. Stolen personal information can ruin your credit, but a malfunctioning power plant can have direct implications for public safety. Electricity, gas, water, banking, all of it relies on computer networks. Systems and power plants and industrial facilities are increasingly reliant on the internet for maintenance, greater efficiencies, and general operations. The challenge is finding the right balance between the benefits of greater connectedness with the risks to safety and security. We're going to explore this topic today with Stan Partlow and Mark Bristow. Stan has been the Chief Security Officer and Vice President of American Electric Power since 2015. Before that, he had a distinguished 25-year career in law enforcement. He held supervisory positions with the City of Columbus Division of Police and was a special agent for the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Mark is the Chief for Incident Response and Management for the Industrial Control Systems Cyber Incident Response Team at the National Cybersecurity and Communications Integration Center within the Department of Homeland Security. Mark has been in this role since 2008. Previously, he conducted assessments and penetration tests of industrial control systems equipment in multiple sectors with a focus on electric power generation, transmission, and distribution. First question is for you, Stan. What is American Electric Power, and as such a big company that operates across multiple states, what are the unique security challenges you face?
American Electric Power is a large vertically integrated utility, meaning we have generation, transmission, and distribution. We serve customers in 11 states, about 5.4 million customers, and we operate in many other states. We have a varied electricity portfolio, including coal, gas, and renewable energy. When I look at the risk profile for our company, certainly I'm always concerned about an attack on the grid, someone actually being able to control the ICS or the SCADA system. And then we also look at attacks on our business network. We do a lot of financial transactions. We hold customer data. So we're always also concerned about someone being able to take that information and use it for a bad purpose.
Stan, would you say the challenges facing smaller utilities are very different from those faced by major players like AEP, Duke, or Southern?
I think it's really about the number of impacted customers and the time that it takes to rebuild. And what I mean by that, when you think about the bulk electric system, the large transmission providers, if those providers like American Electric Power or Duke or Southern Company were taken down, that could have long-ranging effects impacting a lot of people in a very diverse geographic area. The distribution system is much more localized. And when you think about the equipment that it takes to run both of those systems, the equipment that runs the transmission system sometimes is much more complex. It takes a lot longer to get it. In some cases, it's not easily available from a sparing perspective. So I think it's at the end of the day, for the people that don't have power, it's still a really bad thing, whether it's on the bulk electric system or on the distribution system. But I think the defining line for both the utility companies and for NERC is the fact that the impact could be so broad if the attack is on the bulk electric system.
Mm-hmm. Mark, question for you. How are industrial control systems different from the normal computer systems that, you know, most people deal with every day? Are they harder to secure or easier to secure?
Yeah, so you actually interact with industrial control systems every day. You're just not really aware of it. You know, the computers, industrial control systems are basically kind of specialized computers, but at a technical level, they're very much the same. They process data very similarly to the PC you might have on your desk. In fact, you can actually use a PC as an industrial control system computer. I wouldn't recommend it. But really, the real difference is in what they're connected to. Industrial control systems computers run a process, so they have some type of interaction with physical space. And so that's it really is an operational shift, right? They're a lot more, they need to be a lot more reliable. You don't think twice about having to reboot a computer to install a patch, but installing a patch on industrial control systems computer, you know, and bringing that down even momentarily could have impact to delivery of water or electric power or whatever the process is that that computer is running. So you actually interact with them on a daily basis. Even most buildings have things that be classified as industrial control systems to manage their building HVAC or your elevator system. So you actually touch them every day. You just don't realize that they're out there. As far as how to secure them, sometimes the industrial control systems do present some unique challenges, but they also have some advantages. So on the challenge front, a lot of the industrial control systems equipment is older. You have lifetimes and amortization schedules for these equipment that might be on the 40-year time span. So, when companies like AEP are making investments, they're looking to get a return on that investment over a long period of time. And so some of that equipment is installed longer than your typical laptop might be. But they actually have some advantages from a defensive perspective as well. In a corporate environment, you have a lot of users running around wanting to get on Facebook or YouTube or all these types of things that could be risky from a security perspective. In an industrial control system environment, you have mostly machines talking to machines. And so it's a very kind of prescripted environment. So it's a lot easier to detect when something strange happens in that environment to find an anomaly. And then ultimately, you can then do an incident response action or an investigation and see if that anomaly was a legitimate one or potentially nefarious activity.
Mm-hmm. So this is really a question for both you, Stan, and Mark. From your perspective and your experience, what do you see as the greatest threat, whether man-made or cyber, whether man-made such as cyber or natural, to the grid? What do you think? What's the big thing that folks should be worrying about?
Well, from my perspective, I worry about both a physical attack and a cyber attack. And I think that we've seen in the past both of those happen in real time. We certainly followed what happened in the Ukraine. So we know that there are nation state actors out there that have a desire to impact an electric grid at least in the Ukraine. So, we also are concerned about them trying to do the same thing here. We saw a number of years ago in the Metcalf case out in California where someone tried to physically attack some large system transformers and take those offline. So we worry about both of those, and we try to take a holistic view of our security posture so that we include both physical and cyber attacks.
So as a cyber guy, I think my answer might surprise you in that I actually think the biggest risk to industrial control environments today is gray out. We take Ukraine as an example, and I was actually part of the U.S. government team that went over to Ukraine to investigate that issue at the request of the Ukrainian government. And what saved Ukraine from an electric power delivery perspective was that they had a staff that was trained and experienced in operating their distribution systems in a manual capacity. And here in the United States, most operators have only ever understood the system when it had fully automated capabilities. And so we don't have as much training and practice in doing manual operations. So in the event of an actual cyber attack that caused consequence in an industrial control environment, my concern is that our operators won't have that kind of innate experience other than outside of a couple of drills to actually run that process in a manual way, which can bring the service back online even if the computers aren't.
So from a design perspective, do we as a country need to take a few steps back and maybe incorporate more manual controls in our systems?
Well, the industry certainly is looking at that, and there are some initiatives underway where industry leaders are exploring that very issue. And to Mark's point, the more we automate and the more we make things faster and more efficient, the bigger the risk is that we can't fall back to those manual controls. So that's definitely something that's on our mind, and it's something that's being discussed by industry leaders across the board, both big companies like us and the smaller utilities as well. We're all looking at that very scenario for the reasons that Mark pointed out.
Yeah, and I would say that the electric power industry, I think, is taking that kind of paradigm of potentially de-automating some things that are particularly critical. But I don't want to be misunderstood that the automation was put in place for a reason. It increases reliability, service delivery, capacity. There's a lot of really good reasons to do that automation. It was put in for a good reason at first. It's just that we don't have as much practice for that fallback. And I think actually Ukraine, one of the best lessons learned out of Ukraine was perhaps we should dust off those kind of emergency operations plans and at least practice them more often so that if we do have a situation where we have to go manual, we've got some experience in doing so.
Are there interdependencies that really concern you most in terms of, for example, the telecommunications companies, when something happens, getting word out to the public? Can you talk just a bit about that?
So what Mark just suggested is one of those challenges relative to communications, because the only way that manual process works effectively is if you can communicate with the people in the field that actually have to go out and make those adjustments. So we're very concerned about the ability to communicate in one of those crises, not only to get the message out to the public, but just to be able to continue operations. So there are a couple of initiatives that are underway where we're looking at the ability to communicate in an emergency, leveraging the plans and the processes that the big telecommunications carriers already have in place. And we're also looking at that from the perspective of the government coordinating councils and the industry groups like the Electric Subsector Coordinating Council. There is a companion to that on the telecommunications side, and we're trying to make sure that we are all aligned, because at the end of the day, the electricity becomes one of those gateway functions. If it doesn't work, nothing else really works. Water doesn't work. Banking and finance doesn't work. In some fashion, communication doesn't work. Healthcare doesn't work. So we've got to make sure that we have the ability to effectively communicate, and that is certainly one of the interdependencies that we're focused on.
From an interdependency perspective, when you start to look at this holistically, and the U.S. government has kind of broken critical infrastructure in 16 different critical infrastructure sectors, if you start to look at the fabric that is critical infrastructure, you start to see that they all rely on each other to some extent. Electric power is absolutely a key element to that. Communication is also a key element to that. But all the other sectors also have kind of overlap. So transportation, for example. So if you're looking at electric power reliability, so from a generation perspective, a growing percentage of electric power generation in the United States is now being done by natural gas. So natural gas, you can't have a lot of on-site storage for natural gas. So it's kind of just-in-time delivery of natural gas via pipelines. So if you wanted to affect the electric power system, you could potentially use an attack or intrusion on the pipeline system to deny availability of fuel to those generation assets, causing the grid to have to shift to other assets or kind of follow emergency procedures. So as you kind of look for this, you start to see a lot of systemic risk and touch points where they all the sectors really kind of cross over each other. And one of the big initiatives at DHS is we have an office that is focused on trying to identify those kind of cross-sector systemic risk pain points so that we can work with our private industry partners who own and operate these systems to come up with plans to mitigate those risks if they were to come to pass.
Mm-hmm. Question on nuclear power. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission requires nuclear power operators to design systems according to the design basis threat. Can you just talk a bit about what does that mean, and has it been successful in promoting better security?
DHS, at least in my area of DHS, we're not a regulator, right? So different regulatory authorities have their different kind of approaches, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has gone with a design basis threat for doing all of their threats, both cyber and physical. I certainly think it's been an effective approach to a very high severity sector. Nuclear power is very important, and while nuclear power is generally very safe and reasonably clean, if systems were impacted, it could have some significant public health consequences. So they've taken this DBT approach to set the framework for their regulatory structure. I think that it's been effective in preventing cyber intrusions into nuclear power, at least safety critical systems and nuclear power plants. But like all regulations, regulatory standards have trouble keeping up with technology and keeping up with threats. So, you're always going to have that focus more on complying with the regulatory standards than perhaps doing some of the security things that you might wish to do on top of that because of a resource diversion. So it can be a really challenge and kind of a balancing act between putting out standards that are effective but not so overburdensome that they stop you from doing other activities. And I actually kind of take pity on my federal regulatory body partners because it's a really delicate thing to do, and I think it's a challenging thing to do. I wouldn't be in their position if I could avoid it.
So, Stan, how do you manage risk? We talked about the shortcomings of a compliance-based approach. It has to be a risk-based approach. How do you operationalize that approach?
If you think about the design basis threat, one advantage that technique has is it does allow you to quantify the risk and also measure success, which is always a challenge in the security industry because it's difficult to really know what you've prevented. It's also difficult to try to guess what that next attack might look like. The way we've done it at AEP is we've tried to take a look at risk from the perspective of looking at real-world events that have actually occurred somewhere in the world, and then ask ourselves, if that were to happen to us, how would we respond to that? Do we have security measures in place to prevent those? Do we have tools in place to detect them? Do we have the ability to respond to that type of attack if it were to occur in our network? And I think that's helped us really take something that can be very theoretical I think Mark would agree, a group of security folks could sit around and dream up some things that probably will never really happen, but they can get really excited about it. The reality is when you're making operational decisions about resources and spending money and hiring people and investing in tools, you've got to have something that you can point back to. And I think that's one of the reasons that some industries use the design basis threat, because you can actually calculate what the attack looks like and then design the response to that attack, and then you can test it and measure it. So I think there is some room for that in the risk space. But the other thing that, at least in our company, that we've been able to do is try to measure the risk against the total risk to the company. And that's sometimes a challenge, because in a big company, no matter what industry you're in, there are lots of risks. So it's hard sometimes to be able to take the cyber and physical risk and actually align them with other risks in the company, so that when the leaders of the company are making big financial decisions, they really know where to best spend their money. So we've really focused on that. We actually have a risk framework that we use that allows us to take these real life examples and measure them against what we believe we could do. And then it creates a score for us that's based upon an impact and a likelihood, and that score allows us to plot that on a map, and then we can look at those. And hopefully, as we introduce both recovery and resiliency strategies and additional protective strategies, we can take those bubbles and move them. My counsel to my team is the goal is to move everything down and to the left. Up and to the right is bad, down and to the left is good. So we can go back and rescore that same threat using the new, maybe a new preventative measure that we put in place, or a new resiliency and recovery measure, and then we should be able to see those move down and to the left. That's really one of the few ways that you can judge your return on investment, because you don't really know what you've prevented. And unless the bad thing actually happens, there's no way to quantify that.
Stan and Mark, partnerships are critical to strong cybersecurity. Can you talk a bit about the governor's role in advancing strong cybersecurity?
You know, we deal with regulators and with governors and their staffs in all 11 states that we operate in. Generally, what we see is that relationship with the regulators is what we would call left of boom. So usually in the blue sky, they're asking us questions about what we're doing, and certainly they provide oversight to us about our expenditures and those kind of things. At the end of the day, the governors really become the consequence managers, and we oftentimes see them right a boom after the bad thing has really happened. And what I would think is a really good go forward strategy is to try to make sure that we're including the governors and the emergency management staffs in those left a boom conversations, so they have some level of comfort about what we're doing and how we're preparing, and that they understand how we do our jobs. And I think Mark would agree, the electric sector is an incredibly complex organism, and it changes and grows and moves around literally every day. And it's oftentimes difficult for people to understand some of the safeguards that we already have built in there, and certainly some of the investments that we continue to make. So I think one of those relationship issues is around making sure that we're having good, clear communications with the governors, the emergency management staffs. And I know that's already happening when it comes to storm recovery. Because, you know, we have great relationships with the EMAs in our states relative to storm recovery. We probably haven't gotten where we need to go on the security side, particularly in the cyber area. So we're working hard to do that, and I think that's a place that we can all improve.
I think something that you governors and local officials alike can do is really kind of foster a good partnership model. You know, this is cyber is a team sport. And, you're talking to, so at DHS, cybersecurity that we do is all done on a voluntary basis, right? So we need that close partnership with our private sector partners, but also our state, local, tribal, territorial government partners, to kind of make sure that we're facilitating the right communications, information flow, and establishing procedures, so that when we have that bad day, we're not all exchanging business cards at the site of the disaster, right? That's emergency management 101. I think another thing that governors can do is focus internally, so where they actually have kind of direct control, and work with their internal security teams and IT teams to make sure that the state government systems are secure, right? That's an area where they can have direct control to make those improvements. And I think that it's challenging to espouse to others to have good security when your house is made of glass. And so kind of focusing on what they have that kind of operational control over, but then establishing partnerships, encouraging dialogue, bringing in experts to speak to groups and those sorts of things, and just at all sectors. I think the electric power community is a well-established community. I think that they have a really kind of great private sector coordination model. The Electricity Subsector Coordinating Council, the ESCC, is a great group of very dedicated CEOs from a lot of electric power companies. They have strong relationships. I think that a lot of the other sectors could use that model. I think other sectors struggle to have that kind of leadership on the private sector. And I think that's an area where state and local governments could help lead the effort and kind of bring them to a more cohesive model in some of the other sectors.
One other thing to build on what Mark just said is that I would certainly encourage all the governors and their staffs to become involved in GridX. Yep. We've run that exercise now 4 times. It's run every other year, and it really gives people a chance to understand what the threats are to the grid and also what the company responses may look like and how we may be working together, to Mark's point, as partners, not only with our federal partners, but also with those at the state and local level. And I think that that is a great opportunity for the governor's staffs to really understand how we might respond in a crisis. I hope every day that we never have a real crisis that looks like the GridX exercises, because they're very challenging and they involve both cyber and physical attacks. But it really gives you an understanding of how the grid works and some of the strategies that we can use collectively to make sure that we keep the lights on for our constituents.
Stan and Mark, thanks so much for your insight. Closing here, remarks, words you want to leave with our audience?
Well, we certainly appreciate the opportunity to be here. And again, I would echo a couple of comments earlier that Mark said. It is a team event, and we need everyone to help us in this arena. And I would encourage all of the governors and their staffs out there that may be listening to this to don't hesitate to reach out to your local utility companies and engage in that dialogue if you're not already doing it. And I believe that my peers in those groups would be more than happy to have those conversations and establish those relationships. And Mark said something that we all know in the emergency management community, you don't want to be exchanging that business card on the day the bad thing happens. That's not good for anyone. So we need to make sure we establish those relationships up front.
Yeah, and just thanks for the opportunity to kind of speak to your stakeholder base here. And just to echo what Stan said, and I think that it really, cyber is not a technology problem. It is a people problem. People and processes are much more important than the technology side, frankly. We can solve the technology challenges. The hard part is, I think, over my career doing this, is building those relationships and making sure you have those connections so that in the event of emergency, we know who to call, we know what to do, and hopefully we never have that problem. Unfortunately, our adversaries have different designs. And so, make sure that we have those pre-established relationships will really help get power back on, get water back running in the event of a bad day, and then ultimately so that we can get better as a nation.
All right. Thanks, Mark and Stan. And thanks to all of you out there listening. If you're interested to learn more, please go to our website, nga.org, meet the threat, and you'll find more resources there that we've got posted. So best to you. Thanks.